I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation with Rob Gifford about riding the mother road in China and finding hope, but also a mother load of problems. But first, a check-in in California, where lighter winds and lower temperatures today are helping firefighters contain that raging Lake Tahoe wildfire that's destroyed over 200 homes and displaced at least 1,000 people. What weather are they facing next? The fire has engulfed nearly 4 square miles of land and continues to threaten 500 houses near the California-Nevada state line. Joining us from El Dorado County is Sheriff's Lieutenant Kevin House. Lieutenant, what is your sense of how this fire is being contained?
Well, it's a very unfortunate thing. We're doing our best to work on containment. Actually, the last reports that we had, they're estimating containment is somewhere in the vicinity of about 40%.
Right, and yet we understand that weather is a big factor here. What are your concerns?
Well, we've gotten some forecasts, and they're expecting some gusty winds later this afternoon in the vicinity of about 30 miles an hour, and that's a little bit of a concern that it may kick things back up.
4 square miles of land. We went on Google and placed 4 square miles over, let's say, our city here in Boston.
Yeah.
That's the whole city and some surrounding towns. What does that look and smell like, that big an area?
Well, it's a very large area. Obviously, it's not... it's not square as it would sound. It's very rectangular, but as far as the smell, I mean, it's just terrible. It's just, I mean, just smoke, ashy, just a terrible smell that just permeates the entire Tahoe Basin as well as some of the surrounding areas.
Well, convey to us what's the area look like with so many houses gone and businesses gone. We know the school last we checked was safe. How has it impacted the major area where, let's say, tourists might come?
This particular area is really more where people go to do some hiking and things like that, but there's just so much area up there to hike that this is only just one part of it. As far as the casinos and the major businesses up there in Tahoe, they're probably at least 5 miles away from where this fire is actually burning.
Hmm. But the burn has affected people who live there. How many people have had to be evacuated? How many have lost their homes? Just your best guess. How many are going to be able to rebuild? Is there a sense of that?
No, we don't really have a sense of that. I mean, that's going to kind of be dependent on some individual situations as far as insurance and those kinds of things. But certainly a number of people. We're reporting conservatively, in the vicinity of about 230, 250 homes and structures that were destroyed. And, as far as the rebuilding process, a lot of that's going to be dependent on some of those insurance kinds of issues.
Right. Any word on what caused the fire?
No. We know where it was started. They're just still in the process of determining how, and I'm sure that sometime very soon we'll be able to be able to answer those kinds of questions.
How does this fire compare to others? I mean, what's your sense of it?
This is by far the largest fire that we've ever had in the Tahoe area. Pretty devastating, actually, to the community and to, the environment, the lake. You know, they spend tremendous amount of money on the lake itself, just keeping it pure and clean and everything else. And it's going to be a challenge getting it back to that point, but I'm very confident that they're going to spend the appropriate resources to get it back to that point.
Mm. And just, the shock. I mean, it's a beautiful green area. It's not desert in the way we imagine it. I heard someone say, I've seen this on TV, but, that standard sentence.
Right.
How are people reacting to it?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's very difficult to replace something like that. It's, like I mentioned earlier, it's devastation to a lot of people. There's a lot of emotions that go through that. Even during the time when it first started, we had some personnel that actually were in our command post that owned homes that were burnt down. Just a lot of emotion and things like that to go with it that it's going to take a while to get over.
When you say they're going to clean up the lake, this is, of course, Lake Tahoe.
Right.
And we understand that, it's lapping ash, up
yeah.
at the docks and stuff. How do you do that? How do you clean that?
I don't know the answer to that. I'll have to defer that to the experts in that area.
Well, and as you said, they'll hopefully figure out a way to do it. Kevin House, Sheriff's Lieutenant for El Dorado County. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
You bet. Thank you.
China. is trying to contain a growing child slave labor scandal that has shocked the country. Two labor inspectors have been arrested, and a provincial governor has apologized for the abuses. Also today in China, a 22-mile-long bridge that Chinese builders claim is the world's longest sea-crossing structure was formally linked up just south of the business hub of Shanghai. Two contrasting images of this huge country, and NPR's Rob Gifford says the first, a story of child labor, is the one to worry about. He says if China's many problems aren't addressed soon, China might implode like the Soviet Union. Gifford spent most of the last 20 years in China. He was NPR's correspondent in Beijing between 1999 and 2005. He's moved on to London to be NPR's bureau chief there, as you probably know. But before he left China, he traveled the length of China's Mother Road, Route 312, for a series of radio reports. It was a 3,000-mile journey from Shanghai through the rural heart of China into the Gobi Desert, where Route 312 merges with the old Silk Road. And it all culminates in his new book, China Road, A Journey into the Future of a Rising Power. And Rob Gifford joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
What a cast of characters you introduce us to. The Amway salesman, isolated AIDS patients out in the country, Tibetan monks. You sing karaoke with both a prostitute and migrant workers. At one point, you're even called on to deliver a sermon at a Protestant church. But you start with the question, will China become the new superpower or fail like the Soviet Union? So what's your answer? Let's go to the end first.
I guess my headline is that the next decade is going to be crucial. It's not out of the question that China could go on to greatness, but the book is really about the fault lines that are emerging in China. We've seen shiny Shanghai. We know that it is an extraordinary city, that Beijing and the other cities are very strong and very wealthy. But as you travel west, you're really traveling into China's frailties. If the Chinese Communist Party doesn't address them, I think it's not out of the question that if something came out of left field, like the Asian financial crisis of 10 years ago, there could be a real collapse.
What are the fault lines? You speak of the people that you meet along the way, largely the peasants. There's one there.
There's the biggest fault line. There have been 300 to 400 million new people brought into the middle class, but that leaves 900 million people in the countryside, three times the entire population of the United States. They're not all working on the land. They're not all just growing rice, but a lot of them are. And these people are now being left behind, and these people are angry. So you've had a complete switch from 1989 and Tiananmen Square, when the peasants were relatively happy and didn't join in, and the intellectuals were angry. Now the intellectuals and the urbanites have been bought off with an improved economy, and healthcare and education have collapsed in the countryside, and so have the prices of grain, and so the peasants are very, very angry.
Let's break that down even more. When you say in the city, the cities. I think you're right. There's 49 with over a million occupants. We had a demographer on recently who said in something like 10, 20 years, the biggest cities in the world are going to be in China and they're not built yet.
Sure.
That's how quickly it's growing.
Yeah. But I think the danger is that we do tend to see the cities. The focus on the road that I took, making the road the sort of central theme of the book, is very much looking at the sort of exit, if you like. In traditional times, the angry peasants, all they could do was rise up in revolution. They're not doing that now, partly because the Communist Party is really still quite strong. What they're doing is they're just getting on the road. I mean, it's the grapes of wrath. It's the 1930s Dust Bowl. They're fleeing to the cities.
In fact, you carry John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath with you on the trip. You illustrate that the difference between the cities and the farm life or the peasant life is so extreme. You meet a farmer in his field hitching up his water buffalo, at 66 years old with the body of a 40-year-old because he has to work that hard.
That's right. And he's very symbolic because he's a grandfather and his grandchildren live with him. Both his sons, both his daughters-in-law are in the city. And it's very contradictory. When they get to the cities, they are working in Dickensian factories sometimes. But the point is that they can earn more in a month in that factory than they did in a year growing rice. So even though the conditions are bad, this is the very contradictory thing about the sweatshops that we talk about in the West. Of course, labor conditions are not great, but it's kind of compared to what? Compared to growing rice and for the rest of your life and earning nothing, it's much better for a lot of people. And this is very hard to sort of get these contradictions straight in our minds.
When you speak of the people that you meet along the way, they constantly say to you, they refer to themselves as the people. They say, we, the people, the old hundred names. Tell us what old hundred names means and what struck you about when they say we, the people, and when Americans say we, the people.
The old hundred names, they're called the Lao Bai Xing in Chinese, and traditionally there were 100 family names in China. There's like 90 million people called Li and 80-something million people called Wang. There are not many family names in China, so they're called the old hundred names, and they call themselves that. But it always strikes me, because they always talk about woman, Lao Bai Xing, we the people, and of course, the first line of the Constitution of the United States is we, the people, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. But we, the people in America, is such a sort of empowering thing. It's just, this is what the country is all about. And we, the people in China, is always followed by a kind of lament of helplessness.
We don't have those answers, or we'll never be able to change that. And they know, they refer to themselves as old hundred names, just the common person.
The common people. And of course, China has had a very illustrious history in many ways in the past, but it simply hasn't developed a tradition of empowering the individual. The individual has always been a very small cog in a larger Confucian and then communist machine.
What are the other fault lines?
The political system itself is a major fault line. It's much more brittle than we think, because it's a sort of frozen 1950s system. So the only legitimacy the government has is economic. So it has to keep the economy growing so that people don't get angry, because if they don't keep the economy growing, then people won't put up with the corruption anymore. Therefore, pressure to clamp down on polluting factories. Well, you know, if you're a local official and you've got the choice of allowing the polluting factory to carry on polluting and having 300 relatively happy workers in that factory, or closing it down and making those 300 people unemployed, of course you're not going to close it down. So I'm afraid I'm rather pessimistic about whether China can or will take any actions against the pollution and the carbon emissions.
What about the people themselves? Because we spoke about, you know, the frustration of the poor farmers. They can have their land seized. And then there's, you know, these environmental problems that can impact them when something goes wrong and the government hushes it up. But they've been reacting. There's been small uprisings.
That's right. And the Communist Party is strong nationally, but there are, in 2005, I think it was 80,000 cases of rural unrest. At the moment, there are fires burning in separate parts of the country, but they're not joining together in any kind of movement. And the government is very careful to keep them separate, put out the fires as they come up, and crucially, stop the intellectuals and the workers in the city who are disenfranchised and disillusioned from linking up and giving leadership to the peasants in the countryside.
NPR's Rob Gifford. His new book is China Road, A Journey into the Future of a Rising Power. But what future is it? Is it one of, you know, bad labor practices, maybe putting more tainted products in the world market, creating more dissent and having a Soviet Union-like ending? Or will there be reform? We'll have more with Rob. And later in the show, closer to home, the Justice Department is asking some cities to put candidates' names in Chinese on upcoming ballots. But will Mitt Romney, for instance, be sticky rice or uncooked rice? Back after the break Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from Rob Gifford. His book about his trip across China is China Road, A Journey into the Future of a Rising Power, and a kind of amazingly frank exchanges with Chinese citizens. Here's an example. Riding the bus on Route 312, Rob meets a friendly woman who is in charge of making other women adhere to China's strict one-child policy through forced abortions. What happens if they don't want to have an abortion, Rob asks. Well, there's a department of police in each town and county, she says. They will take her to clinic by force. But what if she's 8 months pregnant? Rob asks incredulously. The woman shrugs. There are too many Chinese people. Rob writes, in China's clinics, there are buckets of water to drown the later-term fetuses that don't die during abortions. He is aghast, but pleased to note that others on the bus are as well, something they wouldn't dare express just years ago. And Rob, you also sing Rod Stewart songs with a young woman, actually a prostitute, at a karaoke bar, and you pivot from that funny moment, because you can't sing, to asking her why she was there, and she shows you marks on her arms where she almost killed herself because a boy left her.
That was a really crucial moment because this was just a human being. You know, we often sort of ascribe everything to sort of an economic impetus as though the only reason anyone does anything is because they need to get money. And of course, that is a major part of it. But I suppose what I'm trying to bring out in the book, really, and what is really one of the most crucial points about modern China, is that China is really now becoming a nation of individuals. It's not, of course, it's a long way from that. It's a long way from being that in the American context. But people have more space to live. They have more decisions to make. They can choose what they do. And they're just, this is really the thing, I suppose. It's like they are living, breathing, hoping, fearing, hating people. And this girl, she was working as a prostitute, but she was a tragic person, and she'd had this terrible relationship or a wonderful relationship, and she was sort of doing this to sort of punish herself or punish him, or I couldn't work it out.
She had an internal life,
That's right.
Which really made me think, wow, imagine when 900 million people stop walking lockstep and have internal lives, and you're
absolutely you're and that's the revolution, really, because the implications of that, of course, that doesn't mean there's going to be a political revolution tomorrow, but of course, whether in the Western image of China and in reality, you know, Chinese people have been, I suppose, traditionally the sort of faceless masses, either the coolies of the 19th century or the Red Guards with Chairman Mao in the 1960s, and now they're sort of finding their feet and they're finding themselves, and the individual is becoming more important than the group. Mm. Now, that does have implications, of course, for society.
Right. Just we've come to the lightning round portion, Rob Gifford. Could you just tick off, you know, talk about the physical beauty of the land, just some of the images that come to you as you're, frankly, getting dirtier and dirtier traveling along on trucks and taxis, and some of the images that stay with you.
I came to love the road, obviously, Route 312. It is the Route 66 of China, and it really does see everything. You know, the Yangtze Delta, the factories, miles and miles and miles of factories. It's the Industrial Revolution. And then suddenly you're in the rural heartlands. You know, it is, in a way, it's like crossing the center of America, nothing but grain, your rice or whatever it is being grown beside the road. Gradually towards the Gobi Desert, it starts to get yellow. You skirt the Tibetan Plateau, and then you cross the Yellow River, and you're really in the Gobi Desert. And then as you get towards the end of the road, suddenly there's beautiful mountainous areas, and there's this one wonderful little chunk of, feels like a chunk of sort of Montana plunked down in the middle of the Gobi Desert. And then finally you move out towards, and I think, yeah, the penultimate chapter of the book is called From Sea to Shining Sea, because there's not really a shining sea the other end. But it feels like, I imagine, you feel like when you get to kind of Santa Monica at the end of Route 66.
And just some of the people. We mentioned the girl in the karaoke bar, the farmer in the field. Just tick off some of the people that will stay with you.
Well, one of the most amazing days, really, was the day on which I sat on a bus next to the woman who was head of family planning in that little county, rural county. Turned out she was the person who actually performed the abortions on women in their third trimester of pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, just shocking beyond all belief. And you just feel so furious that this would be going on. But then further down the road on the same day, I'm in a town in the middle of the Gobi, and I'm walking along the street trying to find dinner, and two guys in suits come up to me and say, "Oh, hi, we're the Amway representatives of the Gobi Desert." And they take me to their meeting where they're bringing all their friends to say, "Oh, you too can be an Amway rep." And they're direct selling in the middle of the Gobi, and they are trying to realize this Chinese dream. So just in the space of 12 hours, you get the horror of the old system and the hope of the new.
Rob Gifford, his book is China Road, A Journey into the Future of a Rising Power. He's, of course, NPR's former Beijing correspondent, now the network's bureau chief in London. Boy, on the one hand, you know, your wife and kids have gone on to London, so you're, you know, eager to be there. But was this trying to pull at you?
Sure. Of course it does. It's very, the intensity of it is just amazing. And that's the reason you want to stay. And it's also the reason you want to leave. And I do miss that intensity. Everything really matters in China. It's at that stage. You know, maybe we were there 120 years ago. It matters a great deal. Some of it's life and death, hope or despair. And I kind of miss that. At the time, I kind of needed to leave it. I've been covering China really for 20 years. So I kind of needed a break from it. But then when you leave, you kind of think, oh, I miss that intensity. In the West, it feels like everyone's kind of put their feet up, and that's a good thing in many ways that we've reached that point. But it's just the convulsive change, and just being a witness to it. It's a privilege to have seen it.
And as you say, the tension of not knowing which way it's going to go.
Yeah, and I think it's very much in the balance, and the next 10 or 12 years are going to be absolutely crucial to which way China goes. The Olympics, I'm sure they'll, you know, go relatively smoothly. But then it's like, okay, Olympics over. Where on earth are we going now?
Rob, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, with two tax evaders in a showdown with U.S. Marshals in New Hampshire and Randy Weaver now by their side, we'll revisit the story of Ruby Ridge. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, waiting out the immigration bill and the chance for a future in America. They'll have the story of one undocumented student. That's still to come after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Senate is conducting a pivotal vote today that would jumpstart immigration reform. The bill under consideration would require workplace verification, create a guest worker program, and lay out a way for the estimated 12 million illegal immigrants to gain legal status and work toward citizenship. Supporters hope the fragile compromise they reached earlier this month will move the bill forward. Opponents say its future hinges on the outcome of a series of amendments that would tighten border security and also deny what they call amnesty for undocumented immigrants. But one section of the proposed legislation has broad bipartisan support. It addresses students who came to the U.S. illegally as children, and it grants temporary legal status to high school graduates who enroll in college or enlist in the military. It puts them on a 3-year track for permanent resident status and their green cards. It also makes them eligible for federal student loans and allows them to work legally, options not currently available to them. Well, one such student is 18-year-old Jose. He asked that we use only his first name and that we not disclose the name of the small town where he lives in Southern California. Here and Now contributor Jordana Gustafson has his story.
That would just be like, I don't know, it'd be like a punch in the gut.
This is Jose, sitting outside the restaurant where he waits tables twice a week.
I can't really picture that. Like, maybe they would have to like transport me to San Diego or TJ or something, and like I'd end up there, and then I don't really know much about the deportation system.
Jose's trying to imagine what it would be like if his worst fear came true, if he were caught living illegally in the U.S. and deported back to Mexico.
If I did, I'd definitely take a train or a flight somewhere like to Guadalajara or back home or something as soon as possible. I would just not be comfortable with it at all.
It's not that Jose doesn't want to return to Mexico ever. He'd like to visit the town where he was born. He hasn't been back to Mexico since his family came to the U.S. 11 years ago on tourist visas and stayed. But he's an undocumented immigrant in the U.S. He's illegal. Aside from his expired Mexican passport, he has no driver's license, no legal identification. If he leaves the country, he might not be able to get back in. So for Jose, leaving is not an option.
I'm going to college because I want to create a career here, have a life here, you know, have maybe, you know, get married someday and like have kids and have them go to school here and everything. You know, it's like, it's my homeland. So that would be pretty painful, I guess.
Until 2 years ago, Jose didn't realize he was an illegal immigrant. He only figured it out when he didn't have the Social Security card or permanent resident card that college financial aid applications require.
I totally didn't think that applied to me. It was funny. I guess I was, like, naive at the time. I didn't really know. But I thought those illegal people were the people that I had seen, like, standing in the corners looking for jobs, people that didn't really own a home because we happened to own a home under my uncle's name, which I found out later on as well. And I just thought they were, like, the, you know, your typical border hopper type person. And I thought, oh, since we came on a plane, you know, we must have been fine.
And Jose was fine until he graduated from high school a year ago and started college at the University of California, San Diego. After a few months, his money ran out. He needs financial aid, a grant, a loan, a job, anything. But without proof of legal residency, he doesn't qualify.
I went and spoke with a counselor there at the school. I tried a few times and she said there was nothing that, you know, they could do legally to help me. She said the best thing is not even to try and go out in the city of La Jolla to try and get a job. She also mentioned how there were, like, undercover, you know, people working for the government, border patrols kind of, that there had been some at the school as well.
So Jose finds himself in the same situation as an estimated 50,000 other undocumented U.S. college students. He's unsure of how to pay his tuition. And even if he could pay it, without a work permit, what job could he get once he graduates?
That's a big question that I've been asking myself lately, actually, because, you know, I'm studying and I'm taking classes. And, I mean, my major is political science, and that's kind of like an oxymoron to be an illegal immigrant and trying to get into some government office.
Under other circumstances, it wouldn't be a far-fetched idea. Jose graduated at the top of his high school class. He passed four advanced placement courses, including government and world history. He did peer mediation and ran anti-alcohol and anti-tobacco campaigns on campus. He sat on the board of the local youth foundation and interned for an organization dedicated to saving native trees in his hometown. By all accounts, he's been a model citizen, except he's not a citizen. So now Jose's taking classes at a community college. He pays for school by working at his uncle's gardening business and waiting tables. Right now, he's still on track chronologically with his high school classmates who are enrolled in college. It's just 2-3 years down the line that he's unsure about.
I'm taking these classes for a reason. You know, I'm going to just try to get an AA associate's degree there. After that, I mean, continue my education there for another 2 years. However long it takes, you know. I mean, I can't predict the future or, like, how the laws are going to change, but that's my plan.
Jose can't predict the future, so he and his family pray about it.
Señor Dios nuestro, que ante el anuncio del ángel quisiste que tu...
Every night of the week, they gather in their living room and pray. They hit on the same themes over and over again. They pray for drug addicts, for world peace, and...
Por las leyes de migración, para que haya una amnistía...
for immigration reform. Jose's mother, Yolanda, laments the situation she and her husband created for their children. She's a housekeeper. Her husband washes golf carts at a country club. Besides Jose, they have 5 other children and a mortgage payment.
Está difícil, ¿verdad? Se les dificulta y ves que...
You see, they suffer too, because they're worried. They start to think, what am I going to do? I'm not going to be able to achieve what I wanted to. And we, as parents, feel frustrated. We say, why didn't we come sooner? They should have been born here.
3 years ago, Jose's sister was rejected from a cosmetology school because she's undocumented. And another sister was accepted at several California universities, but since the family doesn't qualify for loans, she didn't bother to enroll. Jose says he and his sisters have no choice but to pray and to wait for changes in current immigration law.
That's my only hope. But, I mean, nothing has been done, so, you know, there hasn't been any hope to hope upon. Yeah.
That's Jose, an 18-year-old college student in Southern California, waiting out a new immigration bill. Jordana Gustafson produced our story. Well, still to come before we go today, is Michael Moore wearing rose-colored glasses when he looks at the healthcare systems in Canada, Cuba, and other countries? Our health reporter takes a closer look at some of the claims Moore makes in his new film, Sicko. That's before we go. You're listening to Here and Now. The U.S. Justice Department wants Boston to join other cities with Chinese populations in providing election ballots with the candidates' names written in Chinese characters. The Boston Globe reported on this translation conundrum today. The problem is there's no exact translation of English names into Chinese, so officials are trying to find characters that can be strung together to sound like a candidate's name. One result, Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney would become Sticky Rice. Massachusetts Secretary of State William Galvin says ballot instructions are already in Chinese, but translating candidates' names is a formula for a disaster, and he joins us on the line. Welcome, Secretary Galvin.
My pleasure.
Or should I call you high prominent, noble educated?
Depends whether you like to call me that or my other name, which apparently is Stick Mosquito.
These are the transliterations of your name. Explain what transliteration is.
Transliteration is an effort at approximating non-Chinese names, names that would be in English Roman letters, into symbols that will approximate what it sounds like, an effort at phonetics, if you will, in Chinese. The problem is everyone agrees there is no one-to-one correspondence. You cannot take the sound A, ah, and find an exact Chinese symbol for that. So consequently, you're required to more or less make up rhymes or charades, sounds like this. And the problem is that in addition to the inexact approach that that represents, there are different dialects in Chinese, so that you could imply a positive meaning, such as you referred to in your opening. I could be referred to, my name, Galvin, could be referred to with as highly educated, prominent, or I could also implicitly have a negative meaning, depending upon how it was transliterated, to Stick Mosquito.
Right.
Or the mayor of Boston, a negative meaning in his name could well imply no independent thought.
Mayor Tom Menino, his name could be interpreted as Barbarian Mud, No Mind of His Own, or Sun Moon Rainbow Farmer.
Right.
What are some of the others?
Well, Barack Obama could either be Bus Horse or also a prominent, educated noble. Fred Thompson could be Virtuous Soup. And again, this isn't meant to make fun of Chinese characters. That's not our intent at all. I just want to point out the very practical problem that this presents. I should point out that not only don't I have a philosophical, a political problem with translating ballots. In fact, I pushed through the legislation that allows me to translate the instructions into Chinese characters. I'm all for it. I have a problem, however, when I'm asked to make rhymes of names, because I think it leads to uncertainty. It could well lead to litigation.
Litigation? What do you mean by that?
Well, we have a number of candidates who may object either to the way their name is transliterated. We have a number of candidates, for instance, on the Republican ballot for president coming up in our presidential primary who've been quite vociferous about issues such as immigration. For instance, Tom Tancredo comes to mind. Hypothetically, suppose Tom Tancredo decides to sue us because he doesn't like the way that his name is transliterated or what rhyme we make out of it.
Well, minority voting rights advocates say that the candidates, first of all, can change their name if they don't like the way it appears on the ballot.
That requires perhaps intervention administratively or litigation. That's exactly what I'm pointing out, that's not what election should be about, not about litigation.
But they also say, and it's also according to the Justice Department, that several cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York, already have this, the transliteration of names, and it works fine.
New York, there has been extensive controversy about this. There have been errors in the past where parties have been misrepresented. The question is, what is the benefit to Chinese-speaking voters? Is it that necessary? And our view is asking these voters to identify the name of the candidate they wish to vote for in Roman letters is not unreasonable. The fact of the matter is that when these folks have registered to vote themselves, or the names they put on their postal boxes are in Roman letters, they are American citizens. They surely have that much knowledge of that. I think it's disingenuous to suggest that they can't vote without this information. And when you balance that against the potential confusion that it's going to create, I think in this case the Bush Justice Department is being unreasonable in pursuing this.
Well, Secretary Stick Mosquito?
I prefer to be called highly educated prominent, if you don't mind.
Okay. Secretary Galvin, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Massachusetts Secretary of State William Galvin talking about a Justice Department request that Boston ballots have candidates' names appear in Chinese characters. Well, up next, Michael Moore's new film, Sicko, will have maybe a reality check. That's all coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now with two items from the world of film. First, a quick note. Actor-producer Tom Cruise can't shoot his new movie at German military sites because he's a Scientologist. That's what German officials say. They have long monitored Scientology, and they say it is a cult masquerading as religion to make money. In Germany, the Church of Scientology is classified as a commercial enterprise, which church leaders dispute. In the proposed film, Cruise is set to play Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg, who led a plot to kill Adolf Hitler in 1944. The German military is concerned that the film won't portray von Stauffenberg accurately. The colonel's son has gone so far as to say, Cruise should keep his hands off my father. Well, Cruise's production partner Paula Wagner says Cruise's personal beliefs have no bearing on the film's contents. Is that true of the next film we're going to hear about? We go from Tom Cruise to Michael Moore. Sicko, the latest film from the Oscar-winning director, opens nationwide on Friday. Like its predecessors, Fahrenheit 9/11, Bowling for Columbine, and Roger and Me, Sicko is provocative. In it, Moore chronicles the failings of the U.S. healthcare system and celebrates the success of healthcare in Canada, Britain, and Cuba, all countries with socialized healthcare systems. Well, some critics say that Sicko is Moore's best film yet. Here now's health and science reporter Alan Cockle decided to find out. He went to see it and has this commentary.
As a propagandist, Moore just keeps getting better. And in the U.S. healthcare system, he finds a big, juicy target.
This is Rick.
I was ripping a piece of wood. I grabbed it right here.
Like Rick, who sliced off two fingers with a table saw.
The hospital gave him a choice. Reattach the middle finger for $60,000 or do the ring finger for $12,000.
Moore doesn't tell us Rick's last name or the name of the hospital, but the story, if true, captures the brutality of life without health insurance in America.
Being a hopeless romantic, Rick chose the ring finger for the bargain price of $12,000.
So he takes us to Canada to meet a man with a near-identical accident. All his fingers are reattached because there's no such thing as an uninsured Canadian. We also meet Moore's Canadian relatives, Bob and Estelle, who staunchly defend Canadian-style health care. And it's true, polls show that most Canadians believe strongly in universal health care. So far, so good. But then Moore takes us to a Canadian hospital to show that there's no waiting for treatment. Can this rosy picture be true? To find out, I did what Mike would do.
Hello?
I called a Canadian. Hi, Mom.
Oh, hi.
How long have you been waiting for your knee replacement?
Officially, June of 06.
So a year.
Yeah.
And when will you get it?
If I go with that doctor, I'm another good year.
Can you go to another doctor and get it quicker?
Well, I've been referred to another doctor who left. And supposedly I've been left on a waiting list for when the new guy comes, so that could be this fall.
A waiting list, because I just saw this new movie by Michael Moore, and it seems to suggest there's no waiting in the Canadian healthcare system.
Oh, no, that's not true.
My mom's not alone. 2 years ago, a Quebec doctor sued the government because his patient had to wait a year for a hip replacement. And the Canadian Supreme Court responded with a ruling that said, quote, access to a waiting list is not access to health care. I asked Michael Moore why he didn't address this aspect of the Canadian system.
The media does such a good job of providing that other side about how horrible the system is in Canada and places like that. My job is to provide the balance to say, here's the other side that we don't ever get.
There's one point in the Canadian section of the film where you actually go out of your way to suggest that there's no waiting in Canada.
Everybody I spoke to in that waiting room gave me their accurate times. Do you have a problem with that?
That's one waiting room, but you know there are long waits in Canadian emergency rooms.
No, there's not. That's a lie. That's a lie. What you just said is a lie.
The same week I saw Sicko, one Canadian newspaper reported that the average time to be admitted to hospital through an emergency room in Quebec was more than 16 hours. The Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians calls overcrowding a chronic national problem. And a 2005 study in the journal Health Affairs showed that Canada had longer emergency room waits than five other developed countries, including the United States.
This guy broke his ankle. How much will this cost him?
Next, Moore takes us to England, where doctors on a government wage live in nice houses and where nobody gets a bill from the National Health Service.
NHS, everything is free.
I'm asking about hospital charges, and you're laughing.
Most Britons use their taxpayer-funded National Health Service, and surveys indicate that most are relatively happy with it. Moore also extols the French system of universal care. So, is it quibbling to point out that about 1 in 10 people in the UK and the vast majority of the French population have supplemental private health insurance? In fact, the OECD says France ranks only behind the US and the Netherlands in the share of healthcare financed by private insurance. Last stop on Moore's Healthcare-O-Rama, another island nation.
Well, I didn't set out to go to Cuba. I set out to go to Guantanamo Bay.
When he doesn't get into Gitmo, Moore takes his gang of uninsured Americans to Havana. He shows them getting MRI scans and other care that Moore suggests is equivalent or better than what they'd get back home. One woman with lung disease buys an inhaler. The drug is salbutamol for the equivalent of 5 cents. Moore tells us this same drug would cost $120 back home.
Hello, Pierce Apothecary.
I asked pharmacist Steve Grossman what a salbutamol inhaler would cost at his pharmacy. Here it's called albuterol, but it's the exact same drug.
I mean, this is the product that's available in the United States. Cost to the consumer would be right around $35 without insurance.
$35?
Right.
Not $120?
Not $120.
So overall, how does Cuba stack up against its U.S. counterpart? Well, the World Health Organization ranks the U.S. number 24 in healthy life expectancy, a measure of health system performance. Cuba is down at number 33, not as good as the U.S., but fantastic for a poor country.
I think if you go by the demographic statistics, life expectancy, infant mortality, they've done an outstanding job.
Richard Cash of the Harvard School of Public Health takes frequent trips to Cuba to observe that country's health system. He says Cuba also developed homegrown pharmaceutical and vaccine industries. Despite that, published reports note frequent shortages of basic medicines. Cash attributes that partly to the U.S. embargo and partly to the Cuban economic system.
A lot of the pharmacies were not, you know, stocked to the roof. Shelves were fairly bare.
What'd they charge you for that baby?
None.
But of course, Moore's point isn't that the United States should emulate Cuba.
It's not America.
It's this.
I think we need to adopt the Canadian system. We need a single-payer system. We need Medicare for all. That's the system we should have. We're the only Western industrialized country that doesn't have this. Do you think all the other, say, 24 other countries are wrong and we're right?
In Sicko, Moore tells of a Los Angeles hospital that dumps a confused homeless woman, still in her hospital gown, out on the street. Of insurance companies that reward staff for denying claims. Of an insured couple who lose their home because they can't keep up with their co-payments. Of an 18-month-old baby who dies because her ambulance has to be diverted to an in-network hospital. Few people would argue this system is adequate. Moore makes a case for change, but he undermines it with sloppy mistakes and by glossing over the shortcomings of healthcare in other countries.
That's Here Now's health reporter Alan Cockle on Michael Moore's new film, Sicko. For more on the film, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team also includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Karen Millen-Medson, Hitesh Hatti, and Virginia Prescott. Vince Fairchild is our engineer, our web producer Ken George, interns Huda Ahmed, Ben Singer, Chris Cuff, and Emily Reddy. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.